Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, March 1st, 2013. We get more in a first-person account from the Bradley Manning court-martial at Fort Meade, Maryland.
How you gonna tell your story? Are you gonna tell it true? Either with or without reason, love has paid the price for you.
Bradley Manning is paying quite a price and prepared to pay for breaking the law to release documents to WikiLeaks. But he's not willing to plead guilty to aiding and abetting the enemy and other counts under the espionage attack. In our in-depth interviews released today at peterbcollins.com, segment two is a conversation with Kevin Gostola. He's a talented young reporter and blogger. You can read his account of the Manning proceedings at dissenter.firedoglake.com. That's the Dissenter blog. And as you're about to hear, Kevin gives us an account of how Bradley Manning, over the course of about an hour, explained himself to this military court and gave the reasons why he decided, after first trying at the Washington Post and then the New York Times, he thought about Politico. He did his document dump at WikiLeaks. Here is Kevin Gostola's description of Bradley Manning's statement to the court martial.
Yesterday, Bradley Manning sat at the table that he's been sitting at for every proceeding, and he didn't do it from the witness stand. He sat at this table and he read a prepared statement. It was 35 pages long. He took about just a little over an hour to read the statement that he himself typed up in confinement at Fort Leavenworth. And what it was, essentially, was a background on how he wound up deciding that there were these sets of documents or videos that needed to be released so that the public could see them and those in the American public could have debates about foreign policy, counterinsurgency strategies, counterterrorism. What he was experiencing overseas, he found to be bothersome and problematic because it just didn't fit. With what he thought was, I guess you could say, morally correct. And he thought that others back home should be able to have discussions about what he was seeing in his daily job as an intelligence analyst or maybe just as an Army analyst. And so what his statement was going through each of the charges that he was pleading guilty, addressing the possession of the information and the willful communication of the information. And ultimately, he was pleading guilty to, as you say in the front of this segment, he was pleading guilty to the less severe charges.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, he's not pleading guilty to any of the major federal charges that the government is pursuing, such as aiding the enemy, which carries the potential of life in prison without parole. He didn't plead guilty to stealing the documents. The government says he stole the documents off of these databases. He didn't plead guilty to violating a federal larceny statute. He did not plead guilty to exceeding his authorized access on a computer. That's a crime that falls under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which has received a lot of attention recently because of Aaron Schwartz's suicide, and he was being pursued under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And so you have these charges that they don't believe, the defense decided they want to fight those in a trial. But the other ones, they thought, well, let's get this out of the way, let's plead guilty, and then let's separate it, and maybe we create an extra burden for the prosecution.
I hope you'll take the time to listen to the entire conversation with Kevin Gostola about the Bradley Manning case, because there are key elements not being reported in the corporate media to the extent it's covering this at all. For example, the Associated Press story does give an account of the guilty pleas entered on 10 counts and some quotes from the statement made by Private Manning. But it doesn't mention that he first approached the Washington Post and they didn't take him seriously. He called the New York Times, but his voicemail was not returned. And ultimately, he did choose WikiLeaks to release the information because he thought that he had seen evidence of criminal activity and secrets and double dealing that the American public should know about. And toward the end of my conversation with Kevin Gostola, since he's been there covering the trial, I asked him about the coverage from other media outlets, including the top corporate outlets. And he pointed out that MSNBC, the alleged progressive channel in this country, has only covered the Manning case once in the last 3 months. And that was on the weekend show called Up with Chris Hayes that doesn't have much viewership. And just to underscore that point, I watched Rachel Maddow's program on Thursday evening looking for her coverage on the Manning case. She did a great job on the voting rights issue. She then plugged the fact that she was going to be a guest on Jon Stewart's Daily Show, spent 4 minutes on that, including a kind of irrelevant set of clips from exchanges that they had had in the past. And Rachel Maddow does a good job on what she covers. But I notice most what isn't covered on her program, and Kevin Gostola did an actual research study, not this week, but related to the previous proceedings in the Manning case, and came up with a stunning near blackout of what is one of the most important cases in recent American history. So take a listen to the in-depth interview. Segment one of the in-depth interview is with Shahid Buttar, the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And among other things, we discuss the troubling Supreme Court decision earlier this week, the 5-4 opinion, which slams the door and locks it tight on any constitutional challenge to the massive surveillance wiretapping program that continues in this country to this day. And the tortured reasoning offered by Sam Alito in the majority opinion drew a strong rebuke from the editorial page at the New York Times, and I agree with some of their comments, like, Alito misleadingly presented the court as a model of restraint and its ruling as a narrow one. But in fact, the decision will likely shut down all judicial review of this pernicious surveillance law, barring anyone from ever challenging its constitutionality in federal court. The Times goes on. The majority ruled that the plaintiffs did not have standing to sue because they cannot show that they have been harmed by the surveillance law. This is a classic catch-22, it says. Since the surveillance is secret and no one can say for certain that their calls, emails, and other communications have been or will be monitored, by the court's logic, no one will ever be able to show standing to bring a lawsuit. The court's decision is a clear-cut abdication of its fundamental role in the American constitutional system of checks and balances, which ensures that Congress and the President are not infringing on protected rights. Well, the New York Times got it right in this editorial. In addition to the wiretapping ruling, I also talked with Shahid Buttar about the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and its brutal detention policies. San Francisco became the 18th municipality to pass a resolution this week condemning and opposing the detention clauses of the NDAA. And we also talk about the recent leaked opinion from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel about whether or not the president has the right to execute people without due process. That's all in our in-depth interview released today at peterbcollins.com. If you're not already a subscriber, hey, step up. $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month or $50 a year, and I've still got a stack of Sybelle Edmonds' book, Classified Woman, to share with new annual subscribers. All the information is available through the links on my homepage, right under my picture at peterbcollins.com. Well, it didn't get much notice, but the Senate has confirmed Jacob Lew as Treasury Secretary. Jack Lew, who's been through the revolving door of government and industry too many times to count, will take up Tim Geithner's job of protecting banksters and corporatists and making sure that the economy is safe for the 1%. President Obama says that, well, there's no apocalypse because today is March 1st and the trigger cuts under sequestration are going into effect. He held a meeting at the White House with congressional leaders. No deal was made, and they left with the recognition that these bad cuts, these arbitrary cuts, are going to go into effect. And Obama, quote, said, "The only thing we've seen from Republicans so far in terms of proposals is to replace this set of arbitrary cuts with even worse arbitrary cuts." And I'm not so sure this isn't the outcome the president wanted, because there's more to come. The potential for a government shutdown just a month away, and the battle over a debt ceiling increase that will come later this year. And this again plays on the poor performance of the president as a negotiator and the bad deal that he made on New Year's Day to get us off the so-called fiscal cliff. Because he got so little in tax increases, even though there's nominally a tax on high-income Americans, it doesn't produce that much revenue. He needed $2 trillion in revenue. He got maybe $600 billion over 10 years. And now the Republicans say, hey, no more revenues, man. That's over. John Boehner, let's make it clear. The president got his tax hike on January 1st. The discussion about revenue is, in my view, over. And this makes it even more difficult. The other piece is the president often starts negotiations by tipping his hand too far to the other side, and then you can't claw your way back. President Obama has a lot of skills and talents. But as I've pointed out more than once, he's a lousy negotiator. And before I smack the Obama team again, I have something nice to say for a change. The administration has joined the legal battle to overturn California's Proposition 8, which denies civil rights and equal status to same-sex couples to get married. And this is the president who took a long time to unravel Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He evolved into supporting same-sex marriage conveniently in time for his re-election last year. And now, I give him credit. He didn't have to submit an amicus brief to the court on this, but it is consistent with his new position. And the awkward problem is that Bill Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act, which will go before the court and have oral arguments on the day after the Prop 8 debate. And will this court, with all the right-wing nuts who are mostly Catholics, find it in themselves to honor the rights of all citizens to marriage equality? If I had to bet right now, I'd say probably not. Meanwhile, over at the State Department, they've issued a revised environmental impact statement regarding the Keystone XL pipeline, released on Friday, a little before 5 o'clock, the usual place you bury things you don't really want people to know about. And while the report makes no recommendation about whether the project should be built, it says there is no conclusive environmental reason it should not be. Now, I haven't read the report. I just have this one news account, so I will withhold any deep judgment about this. My only surprise is that they've gone through this process and it has happened so slowly. I made a prediction, which didn't come true, that Hillary Clinton would announce the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline as one of her exit acts as Secretary of State. But that didn't happen. And now I believe they are setting the stage to approve it And expect a firestorm from environmentalists, but who cares? I think that's the attitude inside the Obama administration. And while the pipeline itself is not going to produce a carbon output, it is going to carry the ugliest crude oil sludge available to man from Canada to Texas, where it will be refined, and then most of it is expected to be sold and shipped offshore. And there are a few jobs that will be created short-term, but we know the job estimates have been padded to include bartenders, waitresses, hookers, exotic dancers, anybody who a pipeline worker might drop a few coins on. And the real issue here is that if the president is serious about addressing climate change, as he said in his inaugural and repeated in the State of the Union, this is the place to start, because he doesn't need congressional approval. It is solely an executive branch decision, and I fear it will go the wrong way. Republican Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan announced today that the city of Detroit is moving into emergency management status. And this is a very interesting and complex issue. I have relatives in Detroit. It is a failed city. And I'm currently working my way through a fascinating book by Detroit news reporter Charlie LaDuff. He used to write for the New York Times. And his new book is called Detroit, An American Autopsy. And when you see how bad things are in Detroit, how it's been mismanaged, corrupt leadership, unfortunately, mostly African Americans who've been at the center of that corruption, including Kwame Kilpatrick, the most recent mayor, who is, I think, still contesting some charges, but has done some hard time in the slammer. But, and here I'll say something nice about Rachel Maddow. One of the things she's given excellent coverage of is the right-wing state-level legislation from Wisconsin to Michigan to Ohio that has been driven by corporate interests and often extracts a pound or two of flesh from organized labor in the process. So Rick Snyder got his Republican cronies in the Michigan legislature to pass this Emergency Powers Act, and then voters overturned it. And what did they do? Well, right after they rammed through the right-to-work legislation, actually not right after, but shortly after, they reinstated the emergency powers legislation that the voters had rejected. And now they are using that to appoint an emergency manager who can ignore the elected officials, can invalidate labor contracts, other contracts, basically becomes a czar. And you can make the case that Detroit is in such bad shape that this can't be worse than what local elected officials have done to it. But the process really stinks, and we'll have to see how all that plays out. We heard a lot about the oral arguments at the Supreme Court this week regarding a challenge to the Voting Rights Act. And I want to recommend to you my friend Robert Perry's comments on this. I'll put up a link to it, but you can read it at his website, consortiumnews.com. The headline reads, "The Neo-Confederate Supreme Court Gearing Up to Restore White Rule Over America." And Bob Perry is one of our most talented journalists and commentators, who offers history and context for current events. He'll take you back to 1965, the origins of the Voting Rights Act. I encourage you to read it. Meanwhile, at the Vatican, the nation-state completely surrounded by Rome, there is a sense of popelessness. I stole that phrase from somebody on Facebook. Forgive me, I can't remember who posted it. But yes, the Vatican is pope-free at this time. Benedict resigned, effective last night, and helicoptered out of the Vatican to the Pope's summer palace at Castel Gandolfo. And when I saw the footage, I thought, oh, Benedict is making his own little ascension to heaven. If you're not a Catholic, you should know that in the Catholic liturgy and in the New Testament is the story of after being crucified and spending 3 days in the tomb, that Jesus was resurrected and ascended into heaven. Now, it's also part of the Catholic mythology that Jesus' mom, the so-called Blessed Virgin Mary, was assumed into heaven. And that event is celebrated each year on August 15th. And so I don't know if Benedict had an ascension or an assumption, but he used an Italian white helicopter to stage his exit from the Vatican. And while I'm glad to see him go, who knows what will follow. And finally today, a story that I missed, and maybe you did too. Aging rapper MC Hammer had a run-in with the cops and told them,
"Can't touch this."
Or something like that.
"You can't touch this. You can't touch this."
MC Hammer lives here in the San Francisco Bay Area. On his driver's license, it says his name is Stanley Kirk Burrell. And he reports that last week he was stopped by a local cop, and in subsequent tweets, Hammer asserts that this was a fat cop. And according to Hammer, the cop, who he refers to as Chubby Elvis, he says, "Chubby Elvis-looking dude was tapping on my car window. I rolled down the window and he said, 'Are you on parole or probation?'" Hammer says, "While I was handing him my ID, he reached in my car and tried to pull me out the car, but forgot he was on a steady donut diet." According to Fox News, Dublin Police Lieutenant Herb Walters told the Oakland Tribune, wow, that's multiple sources, that Hammer was arrested Thursday a week ago for investigation of obstructing an officer in the performance of their duties and resisting an officer. And they sent him to the lockup. He was held at the Santa Rita jail until he was released on Saturday. So that's about 48 hours of rapping behind bars. Hammer stands by his version of the arrest, adding on Twitter, "I will now answer his question," referring to the fat cop. "Contrary to his personal beliefs, all people of color are not on parole or probation, fat boy." All right, we'll give Roy Rogers the night off and let Hammer roll us out. Thanks for listening to this News and Comment, the free podcast from peterbcollins.com.
Can't touch this.
You can touch it. You can click on it. You can put it up on Facebook and say you like it.
Break it down. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. Break it down. Every time you see me, the hammer's just so hype. I'm low on the floor and I'm magic on the mic.
t-shirts that just don't hit. I tour around the world, from London to the Bay. It's hammer, go hammer, hit the hammer, yo hammer, and the rest can't go in play. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. Can't touch this.